Welcome to an episode of Max Planck Florida's Neurotransmissions.
I like how you said an episode as opposed to welcome to the next episode or another episode.
Well, they could be listening to them out of order.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Welcome to an episode.
Yeah.
We should say that every week.
Mm-hmm. I'm Misha.
Hi, Misha. I'm Joe.
I was talking to the audience.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Anywho, today we are bringing you another episode from our Sunposium. So this was recorded on the conference floor at our meeting here in West Palm Beach. And we are going to be talking to two extraordinary tool developers for visualization of how the brain works and what the brain looks like.
So up first, we have Ed Boyden from MIT's Media Lab talking to us about his work in optogenetics and especially expansion microscopy.
Two, I would say, incredibly unrelated things that he manages to get to work together to build like great pieces of data out of.
Yeah, it's really taking these vastly different approaches in a sort of intersectional way to... one, to control the nervous system with optogenetics, and then two, to visualize the connectivity of the nervous system. And people who've listened to the podcast in the past may have heard where we talk about super resolution microscopy. So in this episode, we're going to find out a different imaging technique and what some of the drawbacks are to, you know, the Nobel Prize winning super res techniques and this expansion microscopy technique that... maybe it lets you look at bigger scales of nervous system connectivity. And then we switch gears and we talk to Viviana Gradinaru from Caltech.
And she also has two very kind of separate fields that she's working both in. And she is also a pioneer in the optogenetics field. And she also deals with tissue clearing, which made a big hit in neuroscience and biology in general in the past couple of years.
Right, and one of the advantages that you'll hear her talking about with clearing tissue is that it allows you to image deep into intact brains, basically. These are in brain samples, but still, it's nice to not have to chop the brain up into pieces to get deep down into the tissue and see what's going on.
So if you've heard of something called Clarity, that's what we'll be talking about.
Yeah, we'll be talking about Clarity, and we'll also be talking about some of the big research questions that these tool developers are using these tools for. Viviana will tell us about her work understanding the cellular basis for how deep brain stimulation works. So, you know, people may be commonly aware that, particularly in diseases like Parkinson's disease, people will have these deep brain stimulation sort of pacemakers installed to help fix some of their locomotor difficulties. Well, it actually wasn't really clear how this would work. We knew it worked, but we didn't know how it worked until some of Viviana's work elucidated the roles of different cell types in this process. So that'll be really interesting to hear about. She's also, maybe I'm repeating myself here, but she's the first recipient of Max Planck Florida's Peter Grus Award. So it's the Peter Grus Young Investigator Award. So she's actually rather early on in her career for somebody who's accomplished as much as she has. And this was our conversation with Viviana happened right after she was given this award. So that's pretty cool. But first, let's listen to our conversation with Ed Boyden. And what else?
Enjoy.
Enjoy.
Okay, so we're joined by Ed Boyden. He's a professor of biological engineering and brain and cognitive sciences at MIT in the Media Lab and the McGovern Institute. Dr. Boyden, thank you so much for sitting down with us.
Great to talk to you today.
So you have, going back to even your college days, you have a background in chemistry and physics and electrical engineering. What was it about neuroscience that you were drawn to?
Well, initially I was drawn by the philosophical aspects. You know, could we understand what a thought is, what a feeling is? You know, why do we do what we do? What should we do? And when I was studying physics, I thought, wow, you know, this should be the answer. But more and more during college, I thought maybe it's the brain. And it turned out that my physical sciences training had prepared me greatly for bringing technology forward into neuroscience. So it turned out to work out from a career standpoint as well as from what I wanted to get out of it standpoint.
Right. And by way of background, just for the general listener, I would say that one of the really the biggest papers of this century that really kicked off a whole field of technological approaches to neuroscience was Boyden et al. 2005, the characterization of channel rhodopsin for inducing light-activated electrical activity. So you're a pioneer in developing technology for probing neural circuits function. What do you see as the role of technological advancement in getting at some of these bigger questions that you're talking about, like where does a thought come from, where does, you know, feelings come from?
Well, I mean, it's a terrible analogy, but if we were to compare the brain to a computer, you know, you'd want to have certain tools to understand the computer. You need to control it. You need a keyboard. You have to have a way to regulate what goes on inside. You need to watch it in action. You need a monitor to see the dynamics of the computer, maybe even better than the monitor if you can get away with it. And you need a map. You have to have the wiring, and you have to know how the parts are connected. And so I think that at the bare minimum, we need those three things for the brain. But my hope is if we did have really great maps of the brain, dynamical activity recordings of the brain, and control strategies for the brain, maybe you could actually simulate the computations of a brain in some kind of software. I mean, that would be a very interesting long-term goal.
So if we talk about kind of, I think you are known to a lot of people as a tool developer, right? Like a lot of physicists have you named your major name for yourself, right? And you kind of work with a lot of different things. So you are well known for optogenetics, but you also work with expansion microscopy. We have never actually had anybody talk about expansion microscopy on the show before. We've had a couple people talk about super resolution.
Yeah. So,
right? But this is a really kind of clever, different technique. So can you tell us a little bit about how you have it work to help you understand different things?
So as you mentioned, super resolution imaging lets you see nanoscale dimension parts of cells and tissues. The problem is it's not very scalable. You can't use it to image large 3D objects like brain circuitry. So what we decided to do in my group starting about 5 years ago was, why can't we just blow up a piece of the brain and make it physically bigger? So the way we did it was we actually will embed a piece of brain tissue in a swallowable gel, a polyelectrolyte gel. And people have been embedding preserved tissues and cells in swallowable hydrogels for literally decades for imaging purposes. But what nobody had done was to use it to physically magnify an object. So that's what we set out to do a couple years ago. And surprisingly, it worked pretty well. We can actually magnify brain circuits about 100-fold in volume. And we have some unpublished data showing we can actually magnify it even more, maybe 1,000 to 10,000 times in volume, which means that maybe we can get down to electron microscopy resolution, but on regular old microscopes that everybody already has. So my hope is that not only can we image large brain circuits with molecular precision, but democratize nanoscale imaging by making it a really simple chemical process that anybody can do.
As just a little tidbit, how targeted was this idea? So expansion microscopy, was this a little bit of an accident, or did you have an idea that I definitely want to expand brain tissue to make it more clear and more easier to image, and we want to see what happens? I always had this idea in my mind that somebody was trying another technique like Clarity or something, and brains got bigger and there was like an idea or something from that.
Well, in 2007, I proposed this to my first postdoc in my group, actually, because we thought we could try to solve the tag crowding problem. And what I mean by that is, when you stain with antibodies, the problem is that there's not enough room. Proteins are all very crowded, and there's not enough room to bring in the tags. So around then, we started thinking, why don't we use hydrogels to pull molecules apart in order to make room for tags? But this is right after Palm and Storm came out, and we thought, wow, super resolution is getting crowded real fast, no pun intended. So maybe we'll just let everybody else solve this. And then 5 years later, two grad students in my group were actually trying to do storm microscopy and some other super resolution methods and also electron microscopy. And it was really hard. A year in, we were still with zero data from actual brain circuits. And almost as a joke, we started thinking, why don't we blow up the brain to make it bigger? But this time we were motivated to do it because we had that extra wisdom that comes from struggling with real neuroscience questions. And once we not only had the idea, but realized the importance of it, to make it work was in pretty short order.
Yeah, so, you know, we've talked on this show about Palm instead. What are some of the, the benefits of using an expansion microscopy approach? What are some of the things that maybe your grad students or postdocs were having trouble with that they were able to get around with the expansion approach?
Yeah. So Palm and Stead and Storm, I think, have incredible spatial precision, but so far they've not been used to image extended three-dimensional tissues. Storm and Palm are quite slow. Stead requires very expensive equipment. And so one of the nice things about expansion is that since we physically magnify, we can use really cheap, scalable optics to do the 3D imaging. So we can image billions of voxels with nanoscale precision on a regular old confocal microscope in a matter of hours. That kind of imaging speed is not possible with earlier strategies. So one way to look at it is that you can use cheap, scalable, diffraction-limited microscopes to give you high voxel speed, but your voxel size is the same as, you know, earlier, slower super-resolution methods. So it's sort of a best-of-both-worlds technology.
So I'm curious because, you know, I noticed that your position is with the MIT Media Lab, which seems like a really unique academic environment to be in, especially as somebody who's interested in neurotechnology, neuroscience in general. What is it about the MIT Media Lab that works for you, that like makes it a particularly good environment?
You're basically in an architecture school, is that right?
Yeah.
Are you the only neuroscientist there? Or?
Well, now we've started to hire people on purpose to do neuroscience. A postdoc with Anne Grabiel and Bob Langer, Janan Dadaviran, who works on implantable neural probes, just joined as the Media Lab's newest professor. I joined the Media Lab for two reasons. One is that they offered me a job. 10 years ago, neurotechnology was not yet cool. And when optogenetics came out, a lot of people said, great, more useless neurotechnology. So I was turned down by most of the neuroscience departments that I applied to.
Really?
Yeah, I shouldn't name names, but I was rejected by 1, 2, 3, 4, a whole bunch of different places. And I think neuroscientists were at the time quite distrusting of new tools. New tools seemed, you know, kind of for show, but they didn't actually get a lot done. You know, at the time, there was patch clamp, there was MRI, 2-photon, but I have to remember in 2005, the G-CAMPS hadn't come out yet. Nobody had used the chenodopsins in awake-behaving mice. You know, people were quite skeptical about a lot of this stuff. And I went to the Media Lab in part because they offered me a job. You know, it was that, and I had a few other choices, like I was applying to Google as well, but they were not ready to do wet lab work at the time. But now in hindsight, the Media Lab is a great place to do stuff because there really is no disciplinary boundary. We want to go do nanotechnology or build hardware or do clinical trials or whatever. There's no set sort of disciplines that are at our disposal. In fact, we call the Media Lab anti-disciplinary, this idea that we should not worry about some boundary and then because of this artificial boundary stop our work and then give up. We should just solve the problem.
Is there like a cost benefit to such an environment? I mean, I'm wondering why why doesn't our institute do this? Why doesn't everybody kind of do this? Is such an interdisciplinary approach, does it make research more difficult in any way?
I think it actually helps a lot. I mean, I think a lot of technologies benefit from being incubated out of the harsh light of day until they're ready. You know, expansion microscopy, for example. The first 6 NIH grants that I wrote on expansion microscopy were all rejected because people thought it was impossible, people thought it wouldn't work. And now we've published several high-profile papers on it, so people, and also application papers are starting to come out, which is great. So people now believe in it, but you know, that took 5 years from the time that we actively started working on the project till now. And the Media Lab, because it also has a little bit of unrestricted funding, one of the grad students who worked on it was able to be supported by the Media Lab for a couple of years while we were getting expansion microscopy to the point where everyday biologists could use it to do really powerful science. So I think that the idea of an interdisciplinary place that has no boundaries, that also has some unrestricted funding to try crazy things, I think the world needs more of that. If you look at the really big ideas in biology, they can't be planned. They're serendipitous. It wasn't like somebody said, I'm going to go study jellyfish for 40 years and then express the green fluorescent protein in neurons and revolutionize neuroscience. Nobody had that thought. It was really basic curiosity about fish, jellyfish, and then other people started trying it out, and then the neuroscientists got involved, you know, at a fairly late stage in the game, but you know, the sum of all those unintentional coincidences turned out to be one of the biggest revolutions in biology history.
I'm fascinated by this idea that the skepticism of new technology. So when I started graduate school, it was right when optogenetics was exploding. It actually seemed like everybody was trying to shoehorn in some kind of optogenetic experiment to go with whatever their project was. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the thing that changes that gets people on board with something? Like, why is it now that people are rushing to try expansion microscopy? Why is it now that optogenetics is bread and butter for so many labs across the country?
Well, I think before optogenetics, a lot of neurotechnologies that came out didn't work as well as they might have seemed. I still remember the early calcium indicators, for example, a lot of which didn't work in all the cell types and organisms they were tried out in. The early voltage indicators were similarly very difficult to use and sometimes even toxic. So in 2005, when Carl and I did the first optogenetics paper, I think a lot of people said, you know, great, it's a cool toy, but will it really work in my question, in my system, in my cell types, and so forth? And so what's different now? Why is expansion microscopy spreading like wildfire, whereas optogenetics, you know, took a couple of years to get going? I think it's partly, you know, nothing sells like success. So when optogenetics started working, then suddenly everybody wanted to do it. And very quickly, in the first year or two, 2005 to 2007, as people started to use it and got success, then they would tell their friends. And then it would spread like very, very quickly. And I would say that around 2009 was sort of a big shift. You know, people started saying, great, neurotechnologies are maturing. How do we get more of these things? And that led to this current explosion. The Brain Initiative in the US started because of this desire to make more tools. That was 2012, 2013. Partly it was the tools were getting successful, but also it was partly because we had sort of set the bar very high. Now, if you bring a new tool out, people want to see a demo, right? They want to see that it works in an actual neural system. Previously, people could develop a tool, they would try it out in a cultured cell, they would try it out in some specific organism, they made no claims of generality, and it was difficult then for the tools to get purchased in the community. But now I think we've set the tone in the field. Hey, you know what, if you want a tool to be widely accepted, here are the things you've got to do. Show it working in different systems if you can. Show it working in vivo or in some intact circuit if you can.
And maybe have some idea what the limitations of the approach are a priori, so people aren't trying to buy into something that just doesn't work for them or something like that.
That's right, yeah. I mean, in our papers, we always go the extra mile to try to show when tools don't work as well as when they do. We had this paper on the first non-invasive optogenetic silencing a couple years ago, and we were very clear in the methods to describe, even when we forgot to save certain data. We wanted to be so transparent that there would be no doubt, so that we would have, when we did make a claim, people would believe it, and because it was on real data. Or, for example, one of our recent expansion microscopy papers, the one that was on the cover of Nature Biotech a couple months ago, there are certain cases where one of the highest performance technologies would sometimes fail, and we actually included supplementary figures showing examples where that wouldn't work. And then we had a lower performing but very, very easy method that's maybe the most popular expansion microscopy method currently out there. And for that, we focused the main text on that, not just because it was reliable, but because it was very easy to use. We want to really think about how biologists do everyday biology and make tools that really fit into people's workflows so they can do great science with it.
Great. If we're talking about just one last bit, right, the Brain Initiative, I think one of the things that they want money to go to is not just brain mapping, right, but also understanding how the actual brain architecture functions. There's a lot of signaling that's involved. And so your work on expansion microscopy is for very much a fixed state, but your work on optogenetics kind of tries to figure out how everything works. How do you feel it difficult to combine the two techniques, or, obviously not at the same time, but to extrapolate from one to expand on knowledge in the other? I mean, how do you work with both of these things that are so different from each other all at once?
Yeah, so I actually think there's a pretty good pipeline where if we image a neural system and perturb it with optogenetics and later use expansion to map out its anatomy and molecular information at synaptic connections and so forth, that's a pretty powerful pipeline. And in fact, up till now, my group at MIT has been pure tools, but for the next 10 years, I think we're going to do some real science now because the tools are so good. Let's use them. So a pipeline where we image a neural system, perturb it, and then map it, and then maybe try to synthesize those data sets in a computational framework, I think that's a very powerful direction for the next decade. And we're starting to really look at some simple systems like worms and flies and fish and so forth to think about whether you could make a complete computational model in the next 10 or 20 years of an entire nervous system.
And if you can, what would that mean in the long run?
In terms of what the model should do? Or?
In terms of what the model should do. I mean, are we going to figure out worm consciousness from this, or do we need something else? Is there another step?
I don't think we have a good definition of consciousness. I think the problem with consciousness is that you cannot perturb it or measure it directly, so you can only look at correlates of consciousness. I think in terms of what the models could do, I think there are two very concrete things that we could achieve. Number one, sort of brute force, but could you simulate the dynamics of an entire neural system? And that would be complete, but maybe not the most intuitive. The other is more intuitive. Could we make a reduced model, something very symbolic that encapsulates the essential processes that occur in the nervous system and link it to behavior? And I think that if such a model could, for example, predict what a worm or fly or fish does next, or if such a model could take some set of initial conditions and then predict what would happen with a perturbation, I think there are very specific kinds of functional models that one could make that might be intuitive and simple, but that could potentially help neuroscience think about interpreting systems in terms of their connectivity and mechanisms.
Very cool. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. This was really great. We should probably head to the next session.
So very good talking to you.
Nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you to Dr. Boyden for sitting down and talking to us. It was a really interesting conversation. And it really brings up, I think, what's kind of an important point to think about as a neuroscientist, which is that, you know, say you have all these really great techniques like optogenetics, which you can use to like completely control neural circuits and probe connectivity of different types of cells. And you have like great imaging techniques like expansion microscopy to build basically a complete model of how the nervous system works and is put together and is constructed. You have this incredibly detailed set of data that give you almost like a complete understanding of the nervous system. Say we were able to fully characterize the neural dynamics of an animal, like a C. elegans worm or a zebrafish or something like that. Like your question of like, do we then have like zebrafish consciousness? Is really interesting. What we have is like a full set of data that we don't necessarily know what to do with, but in the end, it helps us to build like a more reductive, intuitive understanding of how like the nervous system functions. So I think, you know, people like Dr. Boyden and our next guest, Viviana Gradinaru, who are developing these really interesting tools, are really opening up new ways to ask questions that we haven't been able to ask before. And then it's sort of only after the fact that we really come to grips with what that means for our understanding of the nervous system. So kudos to him and people like him who are constantly pushing the boundaries of what we're able to do experimentally, because I think without that, like, there's really, you kind of come to a standstill to some extent.
I liked him too.
Cool.
So next up, as we mentioned before, we're talking to Viviana Gradinaru. She is in Caltech and also a very high-profile tool developer. She was honored at our symposium by winning the Peter Grus Young Investigator Award from Max Planck, Florida.
And the first one ever.
The first one ever.
Yeah.
And maybe the best. Who knows? You know, we don't know. And of one. That's not how you do science.
I guess for her, we hope she's the best. And then for future ones, we hope that they're also very good. Anyway.
This is real good banter.
Yeah. This is what people tune in for, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, the real stuff. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about tissue clearing, which, like we said, is a very hot subject right now. Let's us peer deep, deep, deep into the brain, make the brain a piece of glass and make little neurons light up inside of it.
Not really, but okay.
90% accurate. but we look forward to you guys listening to this interview. We also got a lot of great info out of it, so hope you enjoy.
Okay, so we're back, and we are joined by Viviana Gradinaru. She's a faculty member at Caltech in biology and biological engineering and a heritage principal investigator there. And she is the first recipient of the Peter Grus Young Investigator Award. Peter Grus was the president of the Max Planck Society when MPFI was founded. And so congratulations on your award, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to join you.
So we're really interested in how you have structured your lab at Caltech, because you are taking advantage of a lot of your expertise as a tool developer for neuroscience in general, but you have some very interesting questions regarding neurodegenerative diseases and even broader questions than that. So what would you say is sort of the central basic science question that your lab has been interested in?
I am very interested in understanding circuits are underlying neurodegeneration at the fundamental level, with the hope that if we have a good understanding, then we can inform therapies. There's a lot that we still need to understand. MAPS are one factor that we know little about. And when we try to extract such MAPS, we encountered a lot of technological barriers. So that motivated work around tissue clearing and microscopy and labels, trying to find out methods and to perfect methods. And in a way, it's a collection of different technologies, and try to make them work together with the end goal of then going back into the mammalian tissue and trying to label the circuits that we think underlie the effects of deep brain stimulation and get a detailed map. And the reasons MAPS are important is both to improve the therapy and also decrease the side effects. And along the way, at least in terms of deep brain stimulation, it is very important to understand how it works at the fundamental level, but because although it's quite developed for Parkinson, I would say there's not that much to perfect there. It works very well to have people with Parkinson have a better life, really. It could be generalizable. It could be generalizable to other indications. For example, is approved for obsessive compulsive disorder in a different target area, nucleus accumbens. It's been tested for depression with mixed results, partly because we don't know the mechanism, partly because we don't know where to go in the brain. So the hope is to try to understand the basic level, how deep brain stimulation works, and try to generalize this to other indications.
So deep brain stimulation is something that I think a lot of people become familiar with maybe in graduate school. I remember we had patients with Parkinson's that came in, and we saw how the implants worked for them, and it was a really kind of incredible thing, right? Because somebody can essentially flip a switch and the tremor that they have stops immediately.
Yeah, I think I saw a video one time of a guy getting his implant put in, and he was having trouble playing the banjo, and he had Parkinson's disease, and they turned it on, and he was just like wailing away on a banjo. It was
right.
Like almost instantaneous.
And but you know, the mechanism for Parkinson's disease is fairly complicated, and we kind of always thought that, or before the understanding was that deep brain stimulation worked by sort of inhibiting the subthalamic nucleus. Is that correct? And but I think your research points to a larger and more complex picture.
It's a fascinating and endless complex topic, beginning with the fact that deep brain stimulation in itself, the location of stimulation, the parameters, does not have much to do with the underlying cause of Parkinson's disease, which is degenerating dopaminergic cells. The electrode is in a very different area from the degenerating area, so it doesn't have to do directly with the degenerated cells. It works at the circuit level. It was not precisely understood how it works, although, as you mentioned, the normal hypothesis would be that it's by inhibition, because lesioning the nucleus worked, infusing blockers such as Masimo also worked. The process was rather interesting, because when we tried to inhibit the nucleus with opsins, we had a very hard time restoring the locomotion activity in rodents. And that got us thinking about other potential mechanisms at play, namely not the cell bodies at the stimulation side, but the pathways that are involved, either axons en route or synapsing into the area. So now the difficulty was that the inhibitory tools were not perfected. So what we had to do first was to try to make the opsins as good as possible. However, the inhibition was not complete. And the fact that the inhibition was not complete had us look at the axons, and it highlighted the power that the axonal stimulation could have. So at high, and this is an important point, at high frequency, it restored locomotion, and at low frequency, it made it worse, which is exactly what happens in clinics in the brain stimulation. So the fact that we had to perfect the technology made us look at an alternative pathway, which turned out to be very important. Is that the only part? Unlikely. I think it's a combination of cell bodies and axons and connecting areas. And we are still trying to understand the full complexity of the circuits recruited for therapy and the ones that might introduce side effects.
You told a really interesting story today in your talk when you were describing how if there's a slight misplacement of the stimulating electrode in like the subthalamic nucleus, you might, rather than fixing a motor problem, you might actually induce some kind of like social abnormality, like where person starts swearing a lot because there's these sort of multiple pathways between, like, it looked like from your slide, like one was a motor subthalamic pathway and one was a prefrontal subthalamic pathway or something like that. And it was actually, as you put it, a way for you to get interested in trying to look at these pathways a little bit more specifically, like, and led to your development of this Clarity technology. So I was wondering if you could describe a little bit about what Clarity does and what are some of the applications that this technology has been used for?
Sure. Motivated by this long-ranging projections that DBS could affect, we wanted to have a method that allows us to follow these pathways throughout the mammalian brain. This is difficult because the tissue is opaque, so you usually have to resort to slicing it in paper-thin sections and then realign them. This is very difficult to get a very dense bundle that runs throughout the mammalian brain and try to reconstitute it this way. So we've developed methods to make the tissue transparent in a way, importantly, that retains fluorescent labels. So now we can use microscopy and tissue clearing and follow those projection pathways. And hopefully that will give us a better insight why some pathways, when stimulated, cause different behaviors than the immediately neighboring ones, such as is the case for STN, DBS.
And that actually only kind of scratches the surface of some of the approaches you've taken in your lab. Like early on in your career, you were a part of the perfecting the opsins that are used for expressing in mammalian cells and silencing neurons, and there's a newer approach that you guys are taking for getting body-wide expression of transgenes, basically to get, you know, better mapping of whole brains and both the central and peripheral nervous system. So tell us a little bit about this approach that you guys are working on.
It is really complementary to our efforts to try to get to the functional and anatomical understanding of circuits that modulate our behavior. And a critical component is our ability to deliver genes, either for function modulation or for labeling, and we need to deliver them to broad areas. One option is transgenics, but that is slow and it's difficult to generate transgenics with the new tools. Another option is to use viral vector technologies. Those are highly versatile. So we've been trying to bypass some challenges with the viral vectors, namely their ability to transduce, to deliver the genes to very large areas. And we've done that by recruiting the vasculature. Vasculature is a wonderful infusion system that gives you access to all organs of the body. The brain is a more challenging one because of the blood-brain barrier, but that's precisely what we set ourselves to do, to bypass the challenge of the blood-brain barrier. So we've recently reported on a viral vector, adeno-associated viral vector, that when delivered to the bloodstream can deliver genes to the entire brain, which has potential applications in imaging. There's great work now on cortical imaging and the microscope. Are getting better and better. The areas are getting larger. Getting those areas transduced with the latest tools is very important. So a systemic vector can do that. And another one is to try to rescue particular pathways in indications that are not highly localized. And then you need an approach that reaches large volumes.
Okay, well, I think that's about the end of our time, but thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
All right, thank you so much to Dr. Graudinaro and Dr. Boyden for sitting down and talking to us.
Yeah, and that concludes our second episode of this series from our hometown symposium.
Stay tuned for our third and final episode.
Yeah, it's we've got two great behavioral neuroscientists studying, you know, really interesting, diverse behaviors and the neural circuits that control those behaviors. So stay tuned for that. And be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Neuropodcast. Misha is at Salad Zombie. I'm at GW Science. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes and Google Play and SoundCloud or whatever, you know, app you use for your podcast listenings.
You know, whatever you're into.
Whatever you're into.
You know.
Thank you to our scientific communication department and the IT department here at MPFI for helping us put on this live show. And yeah, we'll talk to you next time.
Yeah. Shout out to my boy Jon Snow in Game of Thrones, totally getting it done, by the way.
Yeah, good job, Game of Thrones. You're a good old TV
I assume
show.
We'll put out this episode in about 2024, so no spoilsies there.
Right. Well, I mean, you did spoil that he's still alive on Game of Thrones.
Well,
so
in 2020.
People are starting from the...
That's true.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.